So I want to talk tonight about the future of the Catholic Church, and to do so in a way that is purely suggestive of some possible futures. And I guess I have a little bit of a pedagogical intent in that, which is to keep us open to the possibility that there are any number of futures for the Catholic Church in America. And there's not just one. And there probably aren't just four. To be honest, I just reached for a number. But to me, the point of proposing a few possible futures is to eliminate present trends and just to think about them. So apologies in advance if that's it's not intended to be a super aggressive talk in that sense, but a prospective talk. So four futures, the Catholic Church in America. First, an acknowledgement. I ran across a book a couple of years ago called Four Futures, Life After Capitalism. And that's the inspiration for this talk. Has nothing to do with life after futures of the Catholic Church, has nothing to do with life after capitalism. But I did steal the title because I thought it was a nice way of thinking about present trends. So this is not a talk about life after capitalism. And this is not going to be a talk even about every possible aspect of the Catholic Church. Now, I'm a political scientist and a political theorist, and so I'm going to try to think about four possible political situations or political aspects of four situations that the church might find itself in. Two of those are kind of normal or predictable, and two of those are extreme. So we'll get to them. So this talk is about politics. When I say that this is a talk about politics having to do with the church, that might strike you in a strange way. We tend to think of religions as being primarily confessions of faith with, you know, certain types of association that are attached to them. And I'm not going to be talking too much about belief or aspects of Catholic theology. I want to talk about the church as a political institution or as a type of political society. And the text that I think is relevant for that, I've put it up on the slide, is Ephesians 2:19. I put it up there not to offer like a Bible verse for the talk, but just to point out this was a kind of locus classicus for discussion of the church as an association or as a body of believers through the ages. So we find a lot of, you know, medieval and early modern discussions of this verse. And that is, now then you are not strangers and foreigners, but you are citizens of the saints and the domestics of God, or the household servants of God, fellow citizens with the saints and the servants of God. And this is to highlight two aspects of, or this can be interpreted to highlight two aspects of the church as a body, that we have some kind of fellow citizenship with each other. There's some way in which the church is like a city. Obviously, anyone who's familiar with Augustine is familiar with the notion that the church is a city. There's some bond of common membership, and the church as a whole is subject to God. So everything I say will be kind of quick and probably not too deep, and I not intending to give a full exposition of this verse. Just point out that this would be the aspect of the church that I'm talking about. As recently as the 19th century and still today, this aspect of the church was considered an extremely important one. You might be aware that the First Vatican Council, or the Vatican Council, as it was called, didn't finish its work and was picked up at the Second Vatican Council, so in continuity with the first. And there were a few documents that were drafted as a part of the First Vatican Council. One was going to be a constitution on the church. And I put up here, again, two quotations to illustrate the political character of the church that were in the schemas, which were ultimately not sort of a long story. Ultimately, we're not, Vatican Council didn't have a chance to pass them, and I'm not putting these up here as like a, you know, just putting these up here informationally. Even though these documents were not passed, this notion of the church as an integral or perfect society relating to civil society as a kind of equal or as a partner was and is very powerful. It made a lot of appearances in the 20th century around the time of the codification of canon law, and there are references to this notion of the church as a perfect society throughout the 20th century popes. What does it mean to say that the church is a perfect society? It just means that it has everything that it needs. It can supply all of its own needs. It's a complete with respect to its own ends. So that means that it can provide everything needed for the sanctification of its members and for its governance and relation to other societies. So it's not simply, at least in the Catholic self-understanding, it's not simply an association, or it's not a club, but it's something founded by God, and which is a society like other societies, like civil society, which can provide for itself. So that's just those are just some background points to the way that I think about the church. Those are the two quotations are, we must believe that the Church of Christ is a perfect society that has everything that it needs to satisfy its purposes. And the Church of Christ, the Church is an assembly of the faithful in Christ, a true society, yet far holier than any human society. So I'm going to go ahead and give away the overall point of the talk. The overall point of the talk is that we should not view history linearly. We shouldn't view history as just moving in one direction. We shouldn't view the history of the Church as just moving in one direction. The typical way that this is thought of in the medieval thinkers is that prior to the birth of Christ, all of human history pointed to the Incarnation. All of human history was a preparation for the Incarnation. But between that time, during the life of the Church, until the coming of Christ again at the end of time, we're in something called the caesura, or the sort of cessation period, when history's not really moving necessarily in one direction or the other. We're not moving toward an inevitable triumph of the Church. We're not moving toward an inevitable destruction of the Church. We're not even moving sideways. We might have a period of glory. We might have a trough. We might have a trial. Might have something else. And then Christ might come all of a sudden without any preparation, without any knowledge of what's going to happen. But I think I could be wrong about this. Happy to discuss it too. I think the most common temptation of modern times is to view history as pointing in some direction. So in the early 20th century, that was the expectation of progress. Now, looking around at the Catholic Church in America, it might be an expectation of at best, an upward struggle, or maybe we're about to be consigned to the flames. Maybe the Church has hit a rough patch of its own making that is going to doom it. And all of those are possible. I think the best way to consider the future of the Church is in different combinations of fundamental underlying factors. This is still going to be a political talk. I'm not going to talk about every single one of these in detail. But it seems to me that there are always four drivers of the future of the Church in the United States, any one of which we could focus on for a talk. Church's demographics, church's financials, church's beliefs and practices. I often see these surveys about whether Catholics believe in the Eucharist, or what sort of belief in the Eucharist they profess, things like that. Their practices, the frequency with which they attend services, what role the sacraments play in their life, things like that. And then the one of most interest to me, the Church's political and legal situation. Not the only thing of interest, obviously, something that depends upon these others. Just the one that's of interest to me is our political and legal situation. And so in the options that I present will all plug back into that. each of these four drivers, I think, fits into an overall view, one of two overall views of the relationship between the church and American society. And these I would classify, as I put on the screen, first, that the church is an essential supplement to the American polity. The church has essentially become an essential part of the American polity and offers something to it. And that's an argument that Catholics have made over the last 200 some years, that they are an essential part of the American polity, contribute something to it. There are a lot of different accounts of what that essential contribution is. That's one fundamental way of viewing the relationship between the church and America. And the other is that the church is an essential threat to the American polity. That's something that many people in this country have thought at many times, something that many people think today. Maybe you could say that, you know, just in the way that maybe it's in the mind of some people even more of a threat or danger than it really is, say, to certain ways of life or political debates, whereas we on the inside don't see it maybe as so powerful or dangerous. Certainly it was considered dangerous at various points in American history. To illustrate each of these, I have an image as an illustration of the view or explanation of what the view is that the church is an essential supplement to the American polity. I present this quotation from Tocqueville. "Men of our day," says Tocqueville, "are naturally little disposed to believe, but when they have a religion, they immediately encounter a hidden instinct in themselves that pushes them, without their knowing it, toward Catholicism." It's what Tocqueville saw or thought would be a driver of religiosity, even in a democratic age. "They feel," he says, "a secret admiration for its government, and its great unity attracts them. I am brought to believe," he says, "that our descendants will tend more and more to be divided into only two parts, those leaving Christianity entirely and others entering into the bosom of the Roman Church." Well, maybe things haven't played out exactly like that. That's nevertheless, that view of Tocqueville's has been an inspiration for Catholics who view the church as a supplement to the American polity. On the other hand, you have the papal octopus, one of my favorite images among all images of anti-Catholic 19th century American cartoon art, which there are a lot of very good ones, is the papal octopus. Papal octopus is lurching out all over the world, spreading its eight tentacles, the tentacles of subversion, superstition, evil, tyranny, greed. I think it's contempt of the laws or corruption of the laws, ignorance, and bigotry. So that's Romanism. So mutatis mutandis, not sure what the contemporary papal octopus would be, but there is still, I mean, we're in Texas, so enough said. There is definitely a foot in some parts of the land, even still a suspicion of a Romanism, which maybe for us, we don't really see anywhere in evidence as a threat. So, what are the four scenarios? What are these four futures of the Catholic Church, ways of thinking about how these this different jumble of trends might come together? Well, the first, the sideways market, just where we keep going along roughly as we are. What does that sideways market look like? Things look like they're getting a little better, things look like they're getting a little bit worse. What are some aspects of this, the sideways market, if it doesn't become extreme in one direction or another? This is a graph from the Pew Research Center. In the United States, this is from, I think, fall 2019, the United States, smaller share of adults identify as Christians, while religious nones have grown. So this is a chart of the increasing percentage of those who don't identify with any particular religion. Who are Christian at the top, So you see a slightly declining percentage from 2007 to 2019, and a consistent rise in those who are religiously unaffiliated. This is another chart of those with no religious affiliation and those with regular church attendance. Somewhat surprisingly, this was in a publication of the American Political Science Association in the fall, and this is based on Gallup polls. Somewhat surprisingly, the percentage of Americans who indicate regular attendance at religious services is relatively stable, at least according to their, I'm not sure if they define that as once a month or something like that. And I know I've seen polls which suggest that it's a little bit different, but this, again, so there's been a rise in those with no religious affiliation. In 1939, it was already pretty high, actually. It wasn't zero in 1939. It's 26%. Now you could, you know, poke at that a little bit. Of the 26% who were religious nuns in 1939, how many of them consider themselves ethically Christian in some way that people today don't? There's a lot of ways to complicate that, obviously, but just as a chart and not a particularly encouraging one. So this is another one from the Pew Research Center. Protestants and Catholics shrinking a share of the U.S. population, and all subsets of knowns are growing. So this one takes the first chart and separates out Protestant and Catholic between 2017 and 2019. So percentage of atheists relatively low, just the nuns who have been making inroads. So that's a social background of. It's kind of like, looks to me like sideways movement. It's not falling off a cliff in terms of percentages, but it's not particularly encouraging. What about within the Catholic Church? What about the priesthood? This is from CARA, which is the Center for Applied Research on the Apostolate at Georgetown. This is from 1965 to 2011, numbers of priests in thousands, plotted against numbers of Catholics in millions. So not a very encouraging statistic there. So not gonna, don't have any hypotheses as to the reason for that, but just this is what an at best sideways moving church looks like. Whither the priesthood, where will this go in the future? Well, this is a chart of dioceses. This is current as of, I think, August 2019. It's probably changed a little bit since then. This is a chart of dioceses that have released names of credibly accused priests. And it just occurred to me to put this up here alongside the previous one, because we have to consider what the conditions are within the church that potential future priests are entering into, and what sort of church they're looking at and what's going on within it when they consider whether to enter the priesthood. And this isn't the consider the social consequences in public of the release of those lists and the way that the Catholic priesthood is viewed in public and how its image has been dented. Doesn't that probably on some level affect that graph too going forward? I mean, that's only current through 2011. So another important background condition. Catholics are no longer a majority among U.S. Hispanics. This is from the Pew Research Center as well. This is only a 10-year difference, so this is 2009 to 2019. Percentage of U.S. Hispanics who identify as Catholic and who identify as Protestant. Of course, you could look at the numbers and see whether the total numbers are increasing or not. In 2018, 2019, between 2009 and 2018, 2019, has a 10 percentage point drop from 57% to 47% of U.S. Catholics, U.S. Hispanics identifying as Catholics, so not particularly encouraging as well. A couple of other distressing trends. This data is from CARA as well, and they have all the intervening years or major years in between. This is Catholic practice of the sacraments between 1970 and 2018. Number of baptisms per year in 1970, 1 million, 2018, 600,000. Marriages in the previous year, significant drop off as well. 426,000 marriages, I guess that would have been in 1969 or over 1970, and 143,000 in 2018. Funerals, however, consistent. 1970, 417,000 funerals, Catholic funerals. 2018, 392,000. So even if you don't get married in the church, make sure you get that Catholic funeral plan set up. This will be the last lecture at SMU prior to the coronavirus hitting Dallas County, so just be careful. What? I know, no, I know. I'm not. This is gallows humor, believe me. Gallows humor. Not all dioceses are experiencing this drop-off. We'll comment on them individually, but there was an interesting article in our Sunday Visitor in the fall. Dioceses define the statistic: Diocese of Rockville Center, Diocese of Dallas, Diocese of Phoenix, and Diocese of Orange. So just put up some different statistics here. How would we characterize this this church of sideways trends? If we sort of add all these together, what is going on? It's a political situation of a church that's heavily dependent upon a friendly government. So the political situation of the church would go up and down a little bit depending upon what sort of administration we had and the overall attitude of society toward the church. There's an uneven distribution of Catholic life. I couldn't really find any statistics on this. But it's sort of related to that chart as well. There's an uneven distribution of Catholic life. There are a lot of financially successful parishes. Probably name a bunch off the top of your head. In fact, the parish where my parents lived in Charlotte for many years, I was looking it up, it's now the largest parish in the country, St. Matthew's in Charlotte, North Carolina, which 30 years ago was, you know, relatively small. It's now, you know, absolutely enormous parish, but not flush with clergy. It's not a comment about St. Matthew's. I don't know how many clergy they have there, but there are a lot of financially successful parishes, successful parts of town. They're not necessarily flush with clergy, but they still have a vibrant life. Maybe a large parish administration, large schools, successful schools, things like that. I think the color scheme is kind of irritating the projector there. And other parishes are serving large areas with low numbers of clergy and limited finances. And that, you know, in a sideways, continually sideways moving church, that trend is probably going to continue as well. The legal situation brings the church under increasing financial pressure. We'll come back to that in my kind of coming apocalypse scenario. Could have put it in here and said that it'll sort of be a sideways move thing. But the legal situation has brought the church under increasing financial pressure. Sideways moving scenario, we just imagine that that's you know, a good amount of pressure, but not enough to, you know, bury dioceses and bring parish life to a halt. The church continues to bear witness, but it's institutionally compromised. Its credibility is compromised. A lot of Catholics are saying this. A lot of faithful Catholics are saying this, more make that argument or point out or suggest even, they don't necessarily, not inclined to take the side of the church in public, at least not institutionally. They view it as institutionally compromised and politically ineffective. So, you know, you win some, you lose some, but there's not going to be any, you know, no major political battle that the church has committed itself to over the last generations is going to go its way. So that's scenario one. That's just to continue. Those are the trends that I thought were important and worth discussing that contribute to the current sort of middling situation. Catholic life is going on. There are some really great hot spots of Catholic life. And there are a lot of signs that it's going to be more difficult. I couldn't get any good statistics on donations by age category, but you know, the rough sense out there is that the boomers were great donors to the church, and comparatively younger generations are less so. So there's a combined lawsuits against the church with difficulty in encouraging younger people to donate. Again, that's also looks like a probably at best a fiscal, at best a kind of best a kind of fiscal cliff, and at worst some kind of disaster. Scenario two. This is not going to be a. This is more of a set of political observations and not a comprehensive scenario. But there are a couple of trends in the church that I see pointing in the direction of a resurgent Americanism. Resurgent Americanism. So what do I mean by Americanism? Americanism is a complicated term. It has a specific theological sense in the 19th century concerning the value that's given to corporal works of mercy over spiritual works of mercy. I'm not going to talk about that specifically, but I am going to talk about the idea that the American church is somehow semi-autonomous. And this was something that Leo XIII in his encyclicals pointed to. This is in his encyclical Testem Benevolentiae Nostrae, 1899. For it would give rise to the suspicion that there are among you, which means that there is the suspicion that there are some among you, who conceive and would have the church in America to be different from what it is in the rest of the world. And I think that there are, although there only may be little bits of this, that there are on both the left, forgive me, I'm a political theory person, so on, but you know, people don't like to talk about the left and right of the church, but there are, you know, there's both a kind of left-wing version of this now and a right-wing version of this, which is in part, I think, a reaction to some of those discouraging trends, particularly on the church's response to the sex abuse crisis that I just discussed a few minutes ago. So it's leading to some strange combinations. An appearance of hostility to the Vatican on the right, and maybe I haven't put that in right, and an accommodation to secular American culture on the left. So those I see as both kind of contemporary versions of Americans. I'm thinking of, you know, MAGA hat wearing, you know, American Catholics who hate the Vatican. That's a strange phenomenon. And it's a relatively new one, at least on the political right, as far as I can see. And it's only, you know, it's heightening itself. It's making itself more, it's trying hard to make itself more prominent. You know, some, I'm naming no names, but there are some media outlets which you've probably run across, and you're thinking like, well, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, I don't remember it being so edgy. I just remember it being a kind of faithful Catholic voice. This looks, it's named as though it's a site devoted just to pro-life news. Why is it constantly attacking the Vatican? You know? Again, haven't named any names, couldn't possibly know what we're talking about. You know, so there's more of that, and we all know what the sources of that anger are. But in practice, it is leading to this this strange appearance of a right wing anti institutional church ism. That's not even an ism, but you know, it's leading to that phenomenon. Not sure what to make of it. Just suggesting that if it were taken to its logical conclusion, it could be a new sort of Americanism. There is on the right a new sort of we don't need no stinking bishops. Thing. It's out there. It's very common, actually. You know, this could be, I could be distorting my own vision by, you know, reading the internet where one encounters such things. But, you know, usually click into that area and you'll suddenly, like, you click on that and the next picture will be, like, huge American flags and MAGA gear and stuff like that. And it's very strange. 20 years ago, that was not the case. On the right, there were critics of the bishops, but not of the Pope. So, on the right, then, look at that survey, then, Pew Research Center. This is from January 2018. Half of Catholic Republicans now say Pope Francis is too liberal. And I'm not sure why Pew Research Center pulled the question, do you think the Pope is naive? Like, I don't really don't know where they're getting that. I honestly don't, just as even as a consumer of research, I'm not sure where they're getting that. It could be a code word for liberal, actually, among some people. So, so what are the what would be the consequences of drawing things out in this direction? I would call it an internal institutional distancing. I just made that up. Sounded like a good political science description of the phenomenon. You know, where people who were formerly not alienated from the institutional church start to view themselves as partly so. And maybe I'm highlighting that trend more on the right because that's what I've paid more attention to. Ideological polarization, I think, goes along with that. The tendency, which I'm probably guilty of in this talk, of presenting inter-ecclesiastical arguments as having to do with left and right, or their left and right views on ecclesiastical matters. Or maybe a better way of putting this, we have to view the Pope in American political terms. When he's, again, it's not a talk on the Pope, when he doesn't fit easily into those. Doesn't fit easily into those at all. Could that lead to some sort of de facto schism? There is no such thing as de facto schism. Schism is always de jure. But yes, it could. All of those trends could lead to a further lay imbalance. That means just where the balance has shifted more in the direction of the voice of the laity. Obviously, I'm not against that, the notion that the laity have a strong voice, but the view that begins with kind of systematic distrust of bishops and hierarchy very quickly leads to we don't need that sort of guidance or approval. So those are the two kind of practical likely scenarios. I think both of those are likely. In fact, I think the next two scenarios are just as likely, if not more likely, at least that we should think about them as potentially being likely in order to shake up our view of what the direction of history is. And for this, I took, which you may be familiar with, two books from Robert Hugh Benson, the great writer, highly recommended by Pope Benedict XVI and Pope Francis. Is his book Lord of the World. That's a picture. The picture is from the Cristeros War in Mexico, in which a lot of Catholic clergy were, or a number of Catholic clergy were executed. Lord of the World is a book from 1908. Robert Hugh Benson was the son of the Archbishop of Canterbury. And then when he converted, it was a big, big deal. And he wrote an apocalyptic novel called Lord of the World, whose contents I am not going to discuss, so as not to deprive from you the pleasure of learning the sequence of events by which the Christian Church comes to its complete annihilation in a matter of years. This was written in 1908. There are a lot of interesting futuristic parts of that book, too. He was really fascinated with airplane travel. Air travel, things like that. So the Lord of the World scenario then is the Antichrist scenario, or something very similar to it. And the best I can think of to show what that might have almost looked like is a quotation during the 2016 election from a Harvard Law School professor named Mark Tushnet. And maybe you encountered this at the time. This got a lot of discussion. It's worth revisiting. The culture wars are over. This is in May 2016. You know, what should we do next? What do we need to hold as good legal liberals? What position do we need to hold going into the next 4 years, as we hope? The culture wars are over. They lost. We won. Remember, they were the ones who characterized constitutional disputes as culture wars. They had opportunities to reach a ceasefire, but rejected them in favor of scorched earth policy. For liberals, the question now is how to deal with the losers in the culture wars. That's mostly a question of tactics. My own judgment is that taking a hard line, you lost, live with it, is better than trying to accommodate the losers who, let's remember, defended and are defending positions that liberals regard as having no normative pull at all. So we need to finish the job, you know, finish slaying the beast of, in this case, the cultural right. Trying to be nice to the losers didn't work well after the Civil War, nor after Brown. So he goes on to advise something more like denazification, is the image that he uses next. So that would be, you know, follow that program out in your mind, and you've got an American version of the Lord of the World scenario. Finish off to the best we can, you know, religious exemptions to any, you know, major social policy. Well, there are other things that are pointing in the direction of an apocalypse as well. Diocesan bankruptcies. There's a list of them since 2004. It's a lot of diocesan bankruptcies, starting with the Archdiocese of Portland in 2004, and most recently the dioceses of Harrisburg and Buffalo.
So colors are just chronological?
It's chronological across the three lines. Yeah, just like with a character term. So that's a list of diocesan bankruptcies, not obviously the circumstances or terms pertaining to each one, but that's a list of diocesan bankruptcies. So obviously there have been a lot of further changes to statute of limitations have been lifted. I know in New York, probably elsewhere, or at least rolled significantly back for accusations against clergy. All those can lead to very, you know, large lawsuits. So that's a list of diocesan bankruptcies since 2004. This sort of apocalypse is closer than you think. That's the offices of the Diocese of Dallas being raided last May, I think, somewhere in there, by Dallas police agents. Seizing a whole bunch of files, really everything that they could get their hand on, it seems. And that apocalyptic scenario of a secular invasion of the church is closer than you think. Another data point, this is a total amount of abuse settlements since 1994. It's $1.3 billion in settlements to 1,839 victims. Could get much, much worse in the coming years, depending on how those, depending on how the new wave of lawsuits goes forward. So what could an aggressive president do? Just about anything. I thought of five major areas where an aggressively anti-ecclesiastical president could act through aggressive executive orders in all sorts of areas. Through vetoing of religious liberty legislation, through instructions to administrative agencies. All sorts of agencies touch upon every aspect of our lives, and an aggressive or hostile president could significantly carry out actions in those areas. A hostile State Department posture. State Department has a lot of influence over how the United States stands with respect to other countries, including other Catholic countries. So imagine an aggressive State Department pushing an agenda against laws in Poland or Hungary favoring the traditional family through international institutions. There's a lot of power that the president can have on an international level, to say nothing of judicial appointments. So the apocalyptic scenario is not that far off, but I want to suggest that there's another scenario as well. There's another alternative. After Robert Hugh Benson wrote this book, Lord of the World, people complained that it was too dour, that it was bad. It's a bad story. It's an unhappy ending. Just ends basically with the complete annihilation of the Catholic Church. Which is sort of just finished. So by popular demand, he wrote another book, which was called Dawn of All. So I put it up there with a little picture of a medieval coronation. So Dawn of All came out a few years later, 1911, also makes for very good reading. And the basic idea of Dawn of All, so you don't know how the protagonist wakes up in a kind of haze one day, in a world that's very familiar and yet very different from the one that he had most recently remembered. Very different because he finds that England has converted to Catholicism. Catholicism has triumphed over the entire European continent. The Emperor of Germany is about to be received into the church. Monarchies have been restored in France and through all of New Spain, which probably includes Texas as well. He doesn't at first know how it's happened. And the book doesn't explain exactly what happened leading to this circumstance, but what it does is it identifies a lot of contemporary trends that could have gone in the church's way, things that the church could have capitalized on. Some of those are a little bit, again, don't want to give too much of it away, but some of those are a little bit of the period. So he gives a suggestion that a deeper and deeper understanding of psychological science, which was just coming on the scene at the time, revealed the church to have the true science of souls, right? And people realized this, and so joined the church. But it's a scenario in which there's a real possibility of a restoration of the church to a position of societal power and social dominance. Is there anything out there that we could use to, again, I'm just thinking of these as frameworks by which to, or through which to highlight contemporary phenomena. Is there anything that we can use to see the world in a similar way? If perchance we were to go to sleep today and wake up 50 years from now, and I don't even have all the answers to this question, I'm just sort of suggesting that as a question, what would be the trends, what would be the things that would lead to at least a very successful future for the Catholic Church? What would that be? Well, one thing I think is the presence all through society of vestigial structures, things that are still preserved from Christian civilization, which maybe we don't even recognize as such. I'm thinking of something as simple as beautiful ecclesiastical architecture, even the ruins of old churches in England, something like that. It's a vestigial structure still there, or maybe some of the great cathedrals, which, you know, it's only tourists who go in there. They're not, maybe some of them aren't flooded with congregants every Sunday. People just walk by and kind of take them for granted. Well, guess what? They're still there. They still have reasons that they came into being, and it's not hard to recover them. Maybe that only few people do, or maybe that explaining the significance of those buildings or Christian traditions takes time. I mean, you know, drive around here in December and everybody's got Christmas lights out. Well, I mean, is everyone going to church on Christmas? Yeah, maybe, probably, actually. But maybe or maybe not. So what? It's still preserving something, preserving something that is, it's better than throwing it away, right? And so I would just ask the question, you know, when we there are a lot of these structures left. What are they? Can we think about them, or can in some cases we even dedicate ourselves to finding them and restoring them, or providing an exegesis for them, putting them to different uses, and reviving apparently lost things? This is just a thought that I had a few years ago when I saw this article, and this is from the Daily Telegraph. In 2017, 1 in 6 young people are Christian as visits to church buildings inspire them to convert. So just a couple of very interesting paragraphs in there which suggest this possibility that maybe there are a lot of vestigial structures, the reasons for which have been forgotten, but which could again come back into play. Sometimes all of a sudden, how about, to take a political example, proroguing Parliament happened in October at the request of Boris Johnson, or the Queen's speech at the beginning of the parliamentary session. Yeah, it's just a rote thing. It doesn't mean anything. Queen doesn't do anything. Yeah, until she does, until she decides to assert her authority, until she does something with, makes a little bit of a move at the right time. It's better to preserve these things in the event that they once again become useful. This is just a couple of quotations from this. Around 13% of teenagers said that they decided to become a Christian after a visit to a church. The influence of a church building was more significant than attending a youth group, going to a wedding. Not sure why that was thrown in there. We're speaking to other Christians about their faith. So what is one, what's another aspect of the, what's another aspect of the church that would be kind of like this? Well, I'm going to pick a weird book here for a second. And talk about, throw in the book Roman Catholicism in Political Form by Carl Schmitt. Adrian Vermeule wrote a good little piece on this book for a website called University Bookman a couple of years ago, and it's been a book that's been of interest to me for a while. And Schmitt makes the argument that the church, there is something unique about the church, something that the church preserves in the face of the rest of modernity. And that is an understanding of political representation. I'll come back in just a second to what I mean by that and give you a couple of quotations for him. But before I explain that or comment on it, Schmitt was asking, Schmitt's Catholic phase, was asking just the same question that we are. Is there something in the face of modernity, in the face of the world become, warlike, and hyper-technological, is there something that the church is preserving which might not be apparent, which in some future, in some possible future, could become super important? That, to me, is a dawn of all type question. And there are many different sort of dawn of all answers that one could give. Are there things that the church preserves that might be important? Separate from bad demographics, bad finances, aggressive executive, all the other considerations. A couple of quotations from Schmitt, and then I'll wrap things up. The worldview of the modern capitalist, he says, is the same as that of the industrial proletarian, as if the one were the twin brother of the order of the other. They are thus of one accord when they struggle side by side for economic thinking. This is economic thinking is what he presents as the opposite of the church's way of thinking. Economic thinking is exploitative thinking. There's a kind of continuity between this and Laudato Si, actually. Insofar as socialism has become the religion of the industrial proletariat of big cities, it contraposes a fabulous mechanism to that of the capitalist world. The rationalism of the Roman Church morally encompasses the psychological and sociological nature of man, and unlike industry and technology, is not concerned with the domination and exploitation of matter. In contradistinction, the idea of representation is so completely governed by conceptions of personal authority that the representative, in contradistinction to economic reasoning, the idea of representation is so completely governed by conceptions of personal authority that the representative, as well as the person represented, must maintain a personal dignity. It is not a materialist concept. To represent, in an eminent sense, can only be done by a person. That is not simply a deputy, but an authoritative person or an idea, which, if represented, also becomes personified. God or the people in democratic ideology or abstract ideas like freedom and equality can all conceivably constitute a representation. This is not true of production and consumption. So it's about Petrine authority. The authority of the Pope, the authority of the bishops, authority of priests, the entire structure of the church is representational in this way. And according to Schmidt, that's a different type of politics from the one we're now experiencing, which is totally oriented to the domination of matter and exploitation of matter. It's like it's just a totally, it's something political, but it's oriented around a completely different conception in such a way that the church is kind of an ark or a continued container of this political view of the world, in which we are related to God through the structures in which we participate. In democratic society, we're only, in a way, related to ourselves. There is representation in democratic society, but the representative or the representative government in a democratic society just represents us, something that we've endowed, something that we've created. In the church, if we accept its claims, we're a part of a different type of structure, something in which those who hold office are not representatives of us. They're not representative of our power. They're not endowed with our power. But in a way, they represent us to God, and they represent God to us. So according to Schmidt, the church is a totally different type of political society. And that's something the church has. And the thought that this kind of trying to present this as related to Don of All, the thought that he had was that as economic reasoning becomes more and more powerful, as the technological way of thinking becomes more and more dominant, the contradiction will between that way of thinking and the church will be heightened and heightened and heightened. That could lead to a Lord of the World type scenario where this, you know, bizarre way of thinking is cast aside forever. Or it could, at some point, become the one thing needful. So that's and if it is, then it's the Dawn of All scenario. So what's the situation of the church today? The liberal political settlement is more unsettled than ever, at least if you listen to descriptions of the liberal political settlement by its own defenders, who are very concerned about populist movements, nationalist movements, and even intellectual movements that challenge the existing order. In modern times, the church, though, sought to downplay its own political element, gave up its rule over the papal states in the middle of Italy until Italian unification. Until Italian unification, I wouldn't even have to explain. It wouldn't require no explanation at all to say, obviously, the church is a political institution. Now, the argument is that it still is a type of political institution. It's not one that exercises temporal power, except over a small area of Vatican City. The church lost its territory. It lost its sort of existence as a political entity, and its status as a political power at all, or its existence as a corporate body, was under threat and in question completely until 1929, until the resolution of the Roman question. So for that whole period, the popes were basically trapped in the Vatican, much like Pope is today for other reasons, from what I understand. So the church's thought, it would take longer to develop this, I think, but the church's thought was that, you know, the days of us being a political institution are gone. They're gone. We lost the papal states. So it's time to shift. We're going to shift to a moral and educational voice. And we can leave aside those questions of jurisdiction and power. We're not under any particular threat from the existing. We've made a treaty. The state will mind its business. We will mind our business. And we will use that freedom from political interference to project a moral voice. Well, how's that standing right now? The moral voice is definitely there, but in the minds of many people, weakened, at least in the West. And jurisdictional threats against the church have increased. Just had a ton of slides on them. So the jurisdictional threats against the church have increased. And those threats will probably only grow. So I put up there, threats to the church's jurisdictional independence will soon grow to include calls for the revocation of the Holy See's diplomatic immunity. That seems unlikely to me to occur, but entirely possible that the threat will be made. After all, we're in a country that didn't have formal relations, ambassadorial relations with the Vatican until, what, 1984, something like that, effectively. Coronavirus itself could lead to the restoration of the... No, just kidding. This is Jeremy McClellan, is a comedian, and he put up this tweet, this fake tweet from the Pope yesterday. In your mercy, please say a prayer for myself, Vatican. Now that Italy has been placed under quarantine, we'll be taking back the papal state. Coronavirus shows that interdict is possible, right? I mean, we thought that you thought the Venetian interdict was something from the beginning of the 17th century. Venice is under interdict today, and it's not funny, but I had to make a joke about it. Interdict, vestigial structure. Popes were never going to place anything on under interdict. Well, gotcha. The state just placed all of Italy under interdict, right? Basically, forbidding public celebrations of mass in large parts of Italy. So things can come back anyway. So the Pope could take action, take back the papal states when no one's looking. That's what I'm thinking about. Gotta think more, we gotta think a little bit more creatively. Is there anything the church can explain uniquely? Just talked about one of them. Church is a depositary of political representation, Schmidt. Maybe the church is understanding the human person, which is John Paul II's theme, or maybe the church's understanding of man's relationship to nature. So there are a lot of things that the church still has a unique contribution, on which the church has a unique contribution to make. My thought, again, this is just one angle as a political theorist, is that this aspect of the church as a political society went away, and the church thought it would go away, and the church thought, well, we can make a deal with, you know, civil states to basically get along well. And now the church probably hasn't held up its side of the bargain. It mismanaged itself, mismanaged its own clergy. And now the state is going to say, all right, well, if you can't keep your own house in order, maybe we'll have to come in and give you some helpful suggestions. The Royal Commission in Australia, which was dedicated to examining the church's response to its abuse crisis, recommended to the church that the church no longer consider the priesthood to be a permanent mark. Because the civil power recommended to the church that this way of viewing the priesthood as a uniquely special thing was something that it should reconsider. So again, that's just the tip of the spear there, but there's a lot of metal behind it, so to speak. So there are some things the church can explain uniquely, and there are a lot of different factors that could lead to change. Maybe things that we're not always inclined to think about. We tend to want to think of religious change as coming from the bottom up, and that's true. That's a very important thing. Most of the countries of Europe during the period of their initial evangelization by Christianity depended on the conversion of very important people. That should not be underestimated. It's not just an organic process, is how we tend to think of it. As Americans, we tend to think of religions kind of competing with one another in the marketplace of ideas, or the marketplace of storefront churches or something like that. An important person makes an important conversion and it's public. It's a big deal. Could still happen. Why did Tony Blair wait until he left office? Because it would have been a big deal. It can still be a big deal, and stuff like that influences people more than we think. Integration from within is Adrian Mule's concept. Just putting it up there is the notion that we should seek to place ourselves in every political juridical institution that we can and act there for the common good. Heightening of judicial contradictions. Again, my suggestion is that I only sketched it briefly, that the church thought that it could make this deal with
to save itself after having lost all of its territory. It's no longer going to be a political institution. All we need is freedom to operate and the ability to preach a moral message. And then we can kind of compete in the marketplace just like everyone else. And that, I think, has suffered significantly. Lastly, the exhaustion of liberal modernity. What does that mean? Well, do people believe in the promise of continued economic and technological development? If yes, then everything is chugging along fine. If no, then people are going to be open to some sort of different option. Now, I've only been talking here about the United States. No idea what's going on in any other countries. Situation of the church is different in different places. It's a lot of interesting stuff going on in China, which I'm not even competent to describe. But have an open mind. It's the only message. And my intention has been to put forward a few of the things that might be, and I think will be, important factors in determining the future of the church. So thanks very much for your time.